Hello, and welcome back to the Research VR Podcast, everyone, the podcast about the science behind virtual reality. I am your host, Oz Balabanian, and with me are two new guests from the company Nevermind. We have Dario Zeip.
Hello.
And Milan Goretsky.
Hey, hi.
And of course, my lovely co-host, Peter Luckoff, is here as well.
Yes, hello. Before we start, one short disclaimer. If my voice at some point disappears, it's because of the German legislation government. So you have to imagine I'm living in a country where they just made laws that makes it obligatory for buses to have Wi-Fi till 2050. So you can imagine what kind of infrastructure I have
okay.
here. So sorry for my government country. Whatever. Let's go on.
Are you saying that you're recording this out of a bus?
Not really, but I mean, if your main technology that you need for internet is ready till 2050, and obviously in 2050 you don't need Wi-Fi, but you have 5G or 6G or 20G, who knows, whatever. I mean, you know how much behind we are here.
You keep saying that, but well, today we're here to talk about innovation,
yes,
in innovation. Not networking sense, but on the creative side. So Dario and Milan, you guys are the co-founders of Nevermind, which is as far as I understand, a virtual reality company that is building an animation tool in virtual reality. And you guys have an unreleased app called AnimVR that is currently available for beta testers. And I've just been seeing incredible work being posted places. And so we thought this would be a perfect time for you guys to come in and talk a little bit about what has been happening with animation and virtual reality. Actually, let's start a little bit with your backgrounds. Like, do you guys have a animation background, or is this something, an interest that kind of came out of nowhere and you wanted to develop?
Yeah.
Well, not at all, actually. But, I mean, I've done a lot of, like, music. I studied music composition, and at some point I did sound installations and discovered Unity, and then I started coding, and I made some games and stuff, and at some point the Vive came along with some VR, and I was very intrigued by that. And also at the same time, I'm a resident artist at the Animation Workshop, which is an animation school in Denmark. And I'm always, and even back when I was still in Germany and was studying at an art school, I was always surrounded by a lot of like animation people because I like to hang out with them. And when the first things came out, like Tilt Brush in the beginning, like the painting apps for VR, all the animation people would try it and would ask, hey, can we animate that? Can we make another frame? And it's basically, then I just thought, oh, maybe I try it, make a little prototype and see what happens.
It's usually where things start. And Dario, did you also do you have a similar background?
Actually, it's a little bit different. Like, I don't have an animation background at all either. I'm more from the technical side of things. And I got involved with this because Milan asked me if I could help him out with some technical rendering problems, basically, for like a week or so. And I said, yeah, like, I don't have university right now. I have a week of time. And now it's almost 2 years later, and we are still working together.
When a week-long hackathon takes over 2 years of your life.
Yes. You know you're working on something interesting. Yeah. I had done some VR stuff before on the DK1 and DK2. But I wasn't actually a big fan of VR back then because I was like, yeah, sure, I have a screen strapped to my head. It's not very interesting. I can't really do anything interesting with it. But as soon as I picked up the Vive and had the controllers and I was drawing in Tilt Brush, I was like, this is awesome. And it actually works. Like, the tracking actually works and I can make something useful with this. So that's kind of where I'm coming from. Where it's like, I can use this awesome technology to make useful things.
So you started your own company.
Yes.
Right? And where?
Yeah, just recently.
Where are you based?
The company is based in Denmark.
Mm-hmm.
I love
Denmark. Yeah.
That's where I live.
And I still live in Germany. So in Aachen near Cologne, I'm still studying here.
Oh, nice.
In computer science. So we work remotely, pretty much exclusively.
Did you get any funding, or just how far is your startup basically?
Well, there is not really any big funding or anything. We've just been working on it because we like working on it. And then with all the interest around it, it became more serious. That's also when we thought, okay, maybe we should found a company and this kind of stuff. Since I'm here in this artist residency in this university, I got a little bit of small funds once in a while from the school because they're kind of like pushing, they have a little bit of funds for research and stuff. Mm. And I get a workplace and a place to live, basically. So that's very cool. And that kind of allows, at least allows me to just focus on this and not have to worry about too much other stuff.
Yeah. And
makes sense. So you guys are bootstrapping the company.
Yeah, and, pretty much.
And have been, so.
Yeah. I think it's been pretty nice. We were talking about like getting investors on board, but we like just working on what we want to work on and being like not having to report to anyone. And as long as we have the possibility of doing that, it's pretty cool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think one thing that has been great is since we're only two people, we can change our direction very quickly.
Yeah.
So, you know, if some new thing comes out and we want to integrate it into the app, we can just say, oh, okay, screw what we've been working on. Let's do this first. And so there's really no infrastructure in the way of us being like really, really fast and open about things.
Would you say the Poly integration, the Google Poly integration was one of those where maybe they, you know, Google approach you and they're like, hey, this is something that you should think about. You're like, okay, you know, drop everything for a week and integrate Poly models or?
Yeah, pretty much.
Sense? Yeah.
We were like invited to a game jam that was like co-organized by Google. And
in Berlin?
In Berlin. It was.
In the base?
Yeah, in VR base.
Was it? Yeah, at the VR base.
Yeah, and we heard about Poly before and we were like, yeah, this is pretty cool if you could import stuff from there. So we wrote them, hey, is there going to be an API? And they were like, yes. Do you want to have beta access? And we did that pretty much in a week, as you said. And we had it ready for the game jam and it was pretty cool.
Nice. Yeah, that I'd say you guys were one of the launch partners of like Google Poly when the API came out. I believe there were like obviously Google Tilbrush and Blocks had it, and Mindshow had it as well. On a personal anecdote, when I was doing my my own little projects in AnimVR, when I realized that the Poly integration was already in there, it really changed how fast I could like suddenly like, oh, I need a tent, you know, type on the normal, you guys have integrated the normal VR keyboard, which we talked about talked about last week, actually.
Yeah, the one from the
Qt keys that
that makes
one
sound
from Razer.
No, this is not a VR tracked keyboard, it's not a real keyboard, it's a virtual keyboard that normal VR like released, and it's a kind of a cool floating keyboard that you have almost like sticks on your hand that you jam into kind of like a typewriter, and each key speaks back to you, and it's just like, I don't know, it's a fun little keyboard, and, you don't need to type essays with it, but it's
what
the name
Poly
files.
So maybe someone of our audience doesn't know what is this Poly API.
Actually, do you guys want to take a stab at explaining what that is?
Yeah, sure. I mean, generally Poly is like an online 3D model gallery made by Google or hosted by Google, and you can put 3D models there, and they also provide some that they made, and I think it's meant to be like a thing where everyone who maybe doesn't necessarily know how to create 3D models can just basically like an online library free for everyone to get some stuff and use it in their projects.
And
maybe Dario can say something about the API.
Yeah, and it's basically when they released Poly itself, it was just integrated with Blocks in the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, it was just because you couldn't really save files locally that well. It was meant that you save everything that you may make in Blocks to Poly. And then they opened it up a little bit, so you can also download stuff from Poly via an API. And that's where we kind of hook in with AnimVR, where you can get all the stuff that was uploaded to Poly, or at least everything that people want to share. So you can also upload stuff to Poly and decide you don't want to share it freely, and you just want to have it there in the gallery. And or you can decide, I want to have it under a Creative Commons attribution license, and then people can download it via the API.
Right.
That's really good.
I do want to mention for a second that compared to like Sketchfab, which is a pretty well-known 3D sharing software, I think it's a completely different beast where I think Google is really concentrating on low polygon 3D models that are, you know, artistic, I don't want to say like of a certain artistic style because it limits people, or it doesn't really limit people, but it's not trying to be your art portfolio that you put up on Sketchfab, right? It's like smaller polygon models that you're making, like a house, a car, a tree that you can have up in their repository that, you know, when you're in Anim VR or you're in Mindshow, you can just like, I need a tree, and you can search for it and immediately just grab it from the window and place it into your world. So it works really well for that end. And I think they're also very much thinking about mobile AR, which has its own limitations. I think that's a pretty good summary then.
I think they also plan to do an integration with the whole IR stickers and the whole Pixel IR core capability. So there is some connection between that. But coming back to your software, could you briefly describe what your software does?
Oh, sure. I think I can do one half and then Milan does the other half. That's usually how we roll. So NMVR started out as a frame-by-frame animation program in VR. Basically, you just draw lines and you make frames. And it kind of evolved from there into more of a central exchange program for VR software in general. So we've really been focusing on import and export possibilities. You can like even import Pixar's Universal Scenes description file format by now, which is what Pixar uses for their whole pipeline. So like from the professional formats to just FBX or OBJ import that like people use when they make models at home. And you can export it to all kinds of things. Alembic cache, which you can open in Maya, or you can just load things into Unity. So while we started out as kind of a very content-focused app, where you create things from scratch, by now you can still do that, but you can also just use assets that you made all over the place, bring them to life, tell a story with them, and get them out again. I think that's kind of...
Yeah, I think maybe like one major shift that has been happening over the past half year maybe is that once we introduced like a master timeline and this kind of stuff, it quickly became apparent that you can pull in all kinds of things and you can actually make a movie, you can tell a story, you can render it as a movie or as a like a 360 video or even as a standalone VR app that someone can run on their headset. And so at the moment, we're still kind of perfecting this whole timeline thing and working towards that you can fade in and out stuff. And really, like, we added audio recording just a few days ago so that you can record some scratch dialogue and stuff. So it's really going into this telling a story kind of thing.
Yeah. So to your point, Dario... I think you guys obviously first made it as its own standalone experience where you can, you know, create everything from scratch to the finished product in Anim VR. But where I think a lot of the value even has been coming from for me personally has been using it almost as a middleware for Unity, where I don't really use Unity's in VR editor much. I don't know. I've had some problems with it, but Anim VR. And correct me if I'm wrong, kind of integrates directly into Unity and you can basically jump into Anim VR, draw frames and, you know, strokes, which then turn into meshes in the Unity timeline. Mm-hmm. And it's just all happening in real time, essentially. So maybe you can talk a little bit about that, of like how you're seeing Anim VR being integrated into bigger projects and being used as just a tool.
Yeah, basically, like, I think what we're really excited about with the Unity integration is exactly that a lot of things really suck if you do them on a screen, like placing cameras, even just placing 3D models, populating a scene. It's not fun to do with keyboard and mouse. And Unity has their editor VR thing, which already, I think, works fairly well. But obviously it's limited by that it's a little bit of a hack right now because it needs to run VR in edit mode, which has a lot of technical limitations. So where what we did is that we said, hey, what if you can just create an NMVR like stage file from the Unity editor and you double click it and NMVR opens like any if you would double click an image file and Photoshop would open. And you have all of your specialized tools running in a like optimized real-time environment that's just made for editing right there. And you just save the file and it saves the file in your Unity project, which is just a Windows thing. And then you open up Unity again, or you just switch to the Unity window, it imports as an asset, and it updates with the changes that you made in NMVR. It was actually pretty straightforward to do with the Unity. Unity like added the scripted importer thing, which made it super easy. And
You mentioned that it's kind of not very trivial to do what you just described with the mouse and keyboard. I can imagine that. Now, my first question would be, how much did you, or how much inspiration do you derive from standard software that was already there for doing what your software does? And how do you approach UI and UX in VR? Like, I assume it's very fundamentally different to, let's say, Maya or some kind of other 3D software that I know. Like, also, a disclaimer, I have no idea how animation works and stuff, so my questions are kind of dumb.
I think that's a good question for Milan.
I think it's always a lot of trial and error, like from day one, but until now. I mean, we might have learned some things along the way, but basically, we have a lot of Skype calls. We talk about how stuff should work and how stuff could work and how we would imagine it. And we usually try to talk as long until we kind of think, okay, now we figured this out. Now we just have to make it. And then Dario starts on the backend side of things. And we have these UI bubbles that what's basically all of our UI is built out of. And I just start like duplicating and putting more of these bubbles and creating a little menu and stuff like that. Sometimes I make a drawing beforehand. Usually the things that I first imagine and that I draw, they go into the right direction, but they don't really work. So once we really see it in VR and we can use it a bit, then we just make adjustments and iterate on the design until it kind of works.
And you have also beta testers, right?
Yes.
And how much feedback do you receive from them?
For like, quite a lot. We have an NMVR Slack where there's like kind of the inner circle of the beta testers. I think we have, Dario, you know the numbers. How many users do we have?
Like in total, we have like 250 monthly users, I think.
That's just given access to people by you individually. Yeah, you know, that's not even, you know, you haven't released. That's like people signing up on your website.
I think we had like
you give them key.
1,000-something sign-ups. And I think it's actually a pretty nice conversion rate if you want to think like that. We haven't had like analytics at all until 2 months ago or something, where we were just giving people keys and we're like, okay, probably they use it. But now it's actually interesting to see that people are actually using it quite a lot. It's always surprising.
Yeah.
And out of those like 250 or so, I think we have about 10 to 15 who are kind of like power users who do a lot with it and who are the ones that give us the most feedback.
Do you want to name a few so people can look them up and see their work?
Yeah.
Well, there's definitely Joe Daniels, whose drawing you also see over there. I think he's been one of our longest testers, and sometimes we've really worked closely with him back and forth. So we would make a feature, we would send it to him, he would give us some feedback, we would change things and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's also Nick Ladd. He's been just as much involved. And the cool thing is they're very different, because Joe does mostly exclusively stuff in NMVR. Sometimes he uses Medium as well and brings stuff together. whereas Nick uses all kinds of apps and he just tries to combine everything, and often he ends up using NMVR to do that, and then we just try to make sure that he has an easy time like bringing everything together. Yeah, so it has been really cool.
Yeah, and
I should mention Joe. Joe is actually, I guess, a traditional animator, right? He has the animation background, which I actually thought you guys probably do as well, based on kind of the way you've built the thing. Joe was telling me that there's like two almost schools of thought when it comes to animation. One is, I think, called like on the posing side, and like it's like posing, and then the other is, I'm not an animator, but he was talking about like VR really changing those two schools of thoughts and almost like blending them into one medium. And because the traditional animators have been doing things frame by frame, you know, on paper, and then when computers were introduced, a lot of those methodologies weren't used again. And so yeah, I guess maybe can we talk a little bit about the methodology that you guys are trying to establish or follow or replicate, even like how do you do animations in VR? Do you have to draw frame by frame? Do you have to grab an object and then record its motion over time? Where do you start?
In the beginning, you could only draw, and I think my initial thought was, because I usually like analog animation and I like analog music recording and just things that are crafted by hand and have a certain feel to them because of that. And I think in the past years, with all the 3D animation and a lot of digital stuff, there has been something lost along the way. And a lot of these digital things, they seem kind of dead and empty. So my hope was that if you can use your hands in VR and you use them to craft animations, maybe you can bring back a little bit of this human element into something that is digital. And I think that was the thought in the beginning, but then it also evolved into much more since we're supporting more formats and things now. And I think we're also looking into, Darius doing some research on how to import models and pose any model to do more of a stop motion kind of thing. Maybe he can say something about it.
Yeah, it's basically, I think the main realization is that posing things or making shapes look the way that you want them to look is really easy in VR, and that's pretty hard in traditional like software. So this pose-to-pose workflow is super natural, because you can just like make the poses that you think are important, flesh them out, and then just draw the in-betweens or pose in the in-betweens. You don't need the interpolation anymore as much, because it's easy to do the in-between frames. Once you rely on interpolation, you run into the issue like, how do my splines look? Like, what kind of tangents do I need? How do I need to interpolate between two things? And that's the boring part of animation, at least from the animators that I've talked to. That's like the ones where you look at a window with a lot of splines and curves, and you just sit there for a day and adjust little handles. And that's not really crafting animation anymore. And the nice thing is, you don't need that in VR. You can just make the poses that you want, and you make more if you want them to be smoother. You don't need to interpolate.
Just to explain to people that don't know what posing is, which is also a word that I recently learned. So let's take the animation of like someone jumping. I guess those poses that you were talking about would be like the first frame of the person kneeling down, you know, like gaining that, like charging up their muscle about the jump. And then the second thing you would maybe draw would be at the peak of their jump, where they are and then where they land. And so you have three distinct poses, and then you then go and pose the things in the middle of those.
Yeah, pretty much. That's kind of the approach. And usually you would use like interpolation to make the in-betweens, because you don't care as much about what's in between, and that's a lot of work. But you don't need to do that in VR.
What do you mean by interpolate? Do you mean interpolation as in like it's automatically adding in frames?
Yeah.
To get... Oh, it is.
Yeah, I mean, it's that's not what we're doing in VR. That's what you do in Maya or Blender. basically that you have a character where you clearly define the what the bones are, the body parts, and then you just move the bones into place in the first frame of the jump, and then maybe in frame 10 when you're at the top of the arc, you put them into place, and then you just tell the computer, like, try to interpolate between them, saying, like, if in the middle frame, like frame 5, it would kind of take half of both poses and mix them together. And that can result into pretty, like, can give pretty horrible results, because the middle of the average of the two poses isn't necessarily what you want to have in the middle.
Right. And so
I think one of the main things that we're going for is also that you don't have to hang out in menus or tweak curves or do things that remove you from the creative flow. Because if you think, hey, I want this character to do this pose, then you should just be able to grab him and do it, like, you know, with no abstraction in between your creative thought and actually doing it with your hands. I think we try to optimize the workflows in that way. So because I think we all already hang out too much in menus when we are on the computer.
Would you compare that to like clay motion, where you're doing stop motion with clay models, where you're always kind of playing with the poses and the models, and you're not spending any time in menus, you're just thinking creatively, but you also have an undo button, where with clay you don't.
Yeah, I think that's something.
Definitely goes into that direction, I think. Yeah, and now I forgot what I wanted to say, but Dario also wanted to say something.
Yeah, no, I think that's definitely a metaphor that fits very well, because, like, again, I think the awesome thing about VR isn't necessarily the screen strapped to your head, but that you have hands, which is also why I'm not super excited about mobile VR at the moment, because you don't have hands. Mm. And as soon as you can do things with your hands, interaction becomes much more natural, and you can do this thing where you just grab the arm and move the arm and put the arm in the position that you wanted to be in. Milan dropped out.
I think we lost.
So, I actually have a question. Listening.
Yeah.
I was listening to you right now describing your software, and my heart was kind of melting. And the reason why it was melting is because your attitude, something that I miss in a lot of software. And my question for you is, why is so much of UI in VR so bad? Why is not everyone emphasizing the hands? Why is not everyone thinking exactly the way you are? Why are you so much ahead of everyone else?
Well, Peter,
I think
my examples are every software that I tried, except maybe for the major ones. I mean, everything for creation and editing. Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously, except ToadBrush and Medium, because they have huge teams. So everything from smaller companies where you edit things and you kind of have menus, it sometimes resembles me of old computers, of old interfaces, just doesn't feel natural. I mean, even if you look at Fallout VR, right? I mean, Fallout VR is just basically from the UX perspective. So UX perspective is a nightmare, it's a horror. They just didn't put any thoughts into how you would interact with VR. And I don't know, it just feels to me that sometimes not everyone shares your mindset. Why is it so?
I think it's like, I mean, we also probably wish we would follow our own mindset more than we do. And I think one of the main reasons why people don't do it is because it's really hard. Especially for creative apps, you have a lot of information that you need to present to the user in some way. Like, for example, with our timeline, you might have like 50 different layers. And you need to somehow show that to the user. And it's like, it would be awesome if it would be like in a minority report all the way around you kind of way. But if you do that, the information density is really, really low. And people can't get anything done. So you have to kind of find this balance between having a high enough information density, which kind of brings you back to old 2D UIs. Because if you look at Maya, the information density is crazy in the UI.
Yes.
And it might not always be a good thing. It might be too high there. But if you make it too low, you end up with a lot of scrolling or moving things around. And that's not nice either, because you don't have access to what you need to do. So I think that it's really a pretty difficult balance to find. And it's much easier to just put things on a 2D plane in 3D space and have people touch it.
Obviously, yeah.
Than to come up with...
I mean, maybe one thing that inspires me to at least try is that the older I get, the more impatient I get with computers and with software and with things that don't work the first time I touch them. So if I start some kind of app and I can't figure out how it works, or it's just like a terrible experience, I just quit. I don't spend the time to learn it all. I would have done that maybe when I was like 15 or something, but not anymore. I just don't have the time in my life. And so with all the things that we make, I at least try to make it so that it doesn't annoy me when I use it and when I test it. And I think that's kind of the baseline. I think we both wish we had more time to polish things even more or implement like a real proper concept or like a backend where you can really design the UI or something like that. But for now, the approach is as much time as we can spend on it, we just spend to make it so that it doesn't completely suck.
We'll take it from there. But I think VLAN's standard for not completely suck is pretty high. So... usually it works like that. I make a new feature, I implement something, I just put some random buttons somewhere, and then VLAN tries it and was like, I have no idea how to use this. And then we spend a day actually trying to make it usable. And I think that's a very important step in the iterations that we usually do. And I think it's pretty lucky that VLAN has a pretty good feeling for what's usable and what's not. And I don't have to do that when I'm implementing
things. And I think once we get started, I'm very perfectionistic. So sometimes I drive Dario crazy with these tiny little things that just need to be different.
Do you have any specific examples that you would call out in terms of like that comes to your mind of things that you've worked on that you're happy about how they turned out in Anim VR in terms of the UI and UX?
I think all the stuff we've done recently, right?
I think one example is that for a long time, we were wondering, because we wanted to do this transform animation thing that you kind of like talked about earlier, where you can grab something and then you can record the movement through the scene. And you can't do that in NMVR right now. Mm. And I think that's something that's really missing. And that's something that's annoying me every time I start the app, that we don't have that. But that's something where we needed...
In what way, I guess? Because I can make the frames start running the timeline, and then as it's recording, I'm grabbing the object and moving it, and it's recording its motion, right? It's the frames.
Yeah, you can do that for 3D models, but you can't do that for things that you painted. So if you painted...
I see.
And that's something that feels UX-wise is very inconsistent. But that's kind of because the way that we... two things right now is that for meshes, the content of the animation is your transformations. For things that you draw, it's the individual frames that you draw. And there's this UX concept that you have like the transformation separate from the content, which is like scared us for like half a year to have this additional like concept in there somehow that we need to represent, that you have to have modes to switch between. And I think we talked about that for half a year, like probably like 20, 30 hours on Skype in total.
we would always end up having the same conversation like after a few weeks over and over until at some point it just clicked, and then we figured out how we could do it and how it fits into all the architecture from before and into the workflow of the app. And now we just have to implement it basically. Yeah.
I think
So how does that work, or what, I guess, can you paint a picture for our listeners of like the concept and how and what it means?
So this is probably going to seem really obvious in hindsight, and people will think we are really stupid for not discovering this earlier, but the idea right now, if you have like one timeline, one track in your timeline, you kind of see like a clip, like if you have an audio editing software, you have your clip of sound. And if you have like drawn frames, you have your clip of drawn frames, kind of. Mm-hmm. And that's what we show in the timeline. And then we also have this concept of groups. When you group things together, like their content, basically their clip is as long as anything that's in them. At least that's how it used to work. And things are only like shown in the timeline if like the playhead is kind of in their clip. Like if you have an audio editor, like you play back what's under your playhead currently, and if it's outside of the range, it's not played back. And basically what we were struggling with is that for each layer type, we needed a second clip that is independent of the first one. And it's like, okay, so how do we determine when something's active? Like, is it if either of the clips is active, or like, how do we do that? And basically what we came up with now is that you just specify separately when something's active. We call that an activation track. Now, it's completely independent of what's in your layers. And then you can have as many like tracks to your layer as you want. So you have your content, which is maybe your hand-drawn animations. Then you have your transform animation. You maybe have opacity, anything that you want to animate about your layer. It's just a separate track, and the visibility is completely separate from that. And in hindsight, that seems very obvious to do that. And that's also how it works in a lot of other apps. But kind of like the way our app worked before was very different from that. And that kind of blocked our thought in that direction, I think.
Yeah, I think one thing that happens once we implemented these activation tracks, which are actually now in there, is that all of the cool ideas that we had, like we often would talk like, oh, if we have the timeline, then we can do this, and then we can do this, and this would be really awesome. But then it would be, yeah, but we can't really do that right now. And it would always end up in this dead end, basically. And since we added these activation tracks, anything we come up with, we can actually do quite easily because the infrastructure and the architecture just supports it now. So that's kind of cool when this stuff happens.
In which environment do you build your app?
Unity.
In Unity.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it seems like it. Are there any videos or clips of this latest feature of these activation tracks you're talking about that people can reference to?
I think they're not an idea or public online yet.
I think I put some in the Slack.
So you're in the Slack.
Teaser.
So if you want, you can check out the Slack.
Yeah, if you go to the Slack.
And in the general chat.
Yeah, there's.
I think that's kind of the only place right now. It's not quite done yet. It's very experimental. There are a few bugs, so we don't push. I haven't pushed it through the proper beta yet, because we don't want people to like break the save files and stuff.
But you guys have a Twitter account, and you post things there, so people can follow you there. And we'll have all of the things we're mentioning in the show notes as links that people can go to.
Why are you going, I guess you have good reasons for it, so careful with releasing it to the public? So is it because you have limited resources? Is it because you want to have the software really good before it kind of goes public better? What's your reasoning behind the way how you actually
public? I think it's twofold. One thing is that I think we both have a very high level of quality standard where we think, okay, this is actually releasable. We often get the feeling that it's much higher than for other people maybe. But the other thing is that since we have all these testers now, and it's been really great to be in contact with them and have them, there is some people who actually work with the software, who do jobs or who I don't know, work on their personal projects,
or
and
companies
if
even
we would just carelessly update
production. which seems pretty
so if
scary.
We just carelessly update, then we just would break their workflow basically, and we would have to deal with that. So we now have an experimental branch on Steam, so if you want you can just switch to that. You get all the cool features and the disclaimer about backup your files, but and then we have the other branch, which is just the latest stable thing basically.
I think so far we've had a pretty good track record of not breaking things too badly. For example, save files from a year ago should still load fine through like basically anything that you've made while the beta has been public still works. And it would be a shame if we'd break that too often. I think we might allow ourselves like one backwards compatibility break before we release, just if it allows us to do a lot better and save in load performance. But other than that, if we can manage it, we shouldn't break things too badly, because it wastes people's time, and it wastes especially the time of people who are actually like using our software were important to us.
But I guess you also want to reserve the right to change like the fundamental architecture of the of how things work, you know, in case you come up with a better idea, like the way you're talking about these new activation tracks. And for users not to, you know, go on Steam reviews and downvote you to hell for or just, you know, give you negative reviews for changing things. So I guess that makes sense. Do you have a current release like schedule or timeline that you're working with, or how does that look?
Yes. We're aiming for the end of May. So Dario is currently still writing his bachelor thesis, which is also a little bit related to what we do in NMVR, which is nice. And once he's done, we're just going to work full-time until the release, basically, try to make a really good version.
Yeah, we are aiming for end of May, but we haven't really announced anything properly yet, because it's hard to tell since it's just the two of us.
Sure.
And I need to finish my thesis at some point, hopefully.
Well, welcome to the club. I'm in the same boat as you.
Yeah.
But I mean, compared to the release actual day and date, we have a pretty clear view of what we want in the release version. And I think we've had that for a longer time now. So we're just basically trying to find the time so that we can get feature complete and make sure that everything's polished and works. And as soon as that's the case, then we can release. And then we also already have plans for the next updates and what they would entail.
Cool. Dario, I want to ask you about your thesis, and he was saying that it's related to Anim. Do you want to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. Basically, like the problem that we've been having is that people were asking us, like, hey, can I import FBX models and just animate them? Like, can I rig them or just, basically do mesh animation like you do in a traditional 3D app? And we haven't done that so far because we couldn't really come up with a nice way to do that, because we both think that rigging kind of sucks. It's really not a fun process, especially if you have to skin your models. Basically, for people who maybe not know what rigging or skinning is, just a quick introduction. It's basically if you have your 3D model, it's kind of like this, the what is described as kind of the skin of your character. And if you want to animate the character, you define the skeleton. You just put bones inside. Like if you have an arm, you would like put in like for the upper arm, lower arm, maybe for the fingers, you'd put in bones. And then you need to somehow define what part of the skin is attached to what bones. And that can be really easy if, for example, in the middle of your forearm, it might just be that all the skin around that area is attached to exactly one bone. But at your elbow, for example, or at your shoulder, it might be a pretty complex interaction between different bones, how they move, how should they deform the skin. If you want to have it look nice, you need to kind of take into account the muscles that are under there. So that you get a nice deformation when you move the bones, what do you do when you're animating? And it gets very complex. And usually you do that by just saying, okay, I select this bone, and now I paint my model like you do with texture painting, what parts of the model are influenced by that bone. And then you move the bone a little bit and see if it deforms nicely, and you adjust it, you go to the adjacent bones, you paint them, and that can take hours, even if you're very, very skilled. And there are some automated algorithms to make that easier, but they're not very nice, and they only work on certain models, and they break in horrible ways if the models aren't like perfect. So basically, what I'm doing in my bachelor thesis right now is I'm trying to figure out a way on how to animate 3D meshes without having to rig them first, giving the user the possibility to add a simple rig if they want to. Because in some sometimes it's really nice to have this abstraction of like, I just want to move the arm. I don't care about what the skin is actually is. I just want to move that bone. But you shouldn't have to do that. You should be able to just import a model, grab the arm, pull on it, and the thing should do the right thing. There are a few techniques.
So what's missing now that I guess needs to be invented for that to be a thing?
Basically, it's mostly that there's a lot of existing research in that area, but a lot of it is very specific to certain use cases, and most of it doesn't take into account VR and that you have hands. So basically what I'm doing now is I'm looking at all the existing research in that area. I'm building a workflow on top of that, adjusting it where it might need adjustment, trying to make it all work together, and then coming up with a way to interact with the model that I'm building and with the data structure that I'm building in a nice way in VR. So that's kind of what my thesis is about. I'm not quite sure if it's going to work out well. I can't promise anything there because it's research. It might fail, and that's okay. But so far, it's looking.
But if it works, it goes straight into NMVR. Yeah,
pretty much.
And I think, everything that I've seen that he tried to work on is usually works on.
I hope you figured out the right agreement on IP with your university.
Oh yeah, I'm already talking to them. Yeah, it's.
Smart.
It was smart. Quite a shock when I realized that my university owns everything I work on when doing my bachelor thesis.
It's actually a nasty thing.
Yeah, it's. But that's something for bachelor students to watch out for. University students, if you work for the university, they own everything that you do. So make sure that you lawyer up.
lawyer up at the gym, delete Facebook.
That's
right?
Horrible. Yes.
Always have the I think friend. The problem that you're describing here, that of rigging, and having that be a huge bottleneck for animation was mentioned a few episodes ago by Nathan Rowe from Sculptor VR. So he's created his own voxel engine for Sculptor, and one of the things he was really trying to explore was also that same idea of like, can you somehow automate the rigging aspect of these 3D models that you're sculpting and then be able to animate them? So maybe there's some intersection there that you guys can talk about.
Yes.
I mean, I think all of the people we've met, like the guys from Medium and the people who make blogs and probably also Nathan, I think everyone would be happy if there was like a nice solution for that, because I think that would add so much to what you can... how you can use the stuff you can create in these apps and how you can take your work further. So that would be really cool.
Yeah.
Or better yet, you could just do the mocap animation yourself and then have that be at least nice something you can, as a template to work off of. No, with two hands and a headset and maybe some Vive trackers, you could do the full thing. I don't know. Although I think animators, like when I was talking to Joe, he was kind of against the idea of using his own performance capture as capture because I think it goes to like the fundamentals of like what they've learned as animators is to, I guess, not to embody so much of yourself into the character, but to imagine beyond. I don't know. There's some interesting conversations that we had there where some like Disney animators I've seen like have a mirror in front of them and they're just kind of mirroring their own facial expressions and trying to exaggerate them on paper. And I think Joe had a different method when it came to that.
When it comes to like motion capture, I have a little bit of the same, because to me, it just never looks, because I think animation is a craft and also an art form.
Yeah.
And just digitizing a movement doesn't necessarily make it into a beautiful movement or something, has been really thought through. And I think that's just, I'm more pleased looking at things that have been crafted by people for others to enjoy and with a specific meaning. And I think that's just a little bit harder with motion capturing. Okay, but
couldn't you use something like either an emoji style or more, let's say, deep neural networks that interpolate between the different stages? So you mentioned before at the beginning of the podcast example where you have someone who wants to jump and he starts to squat, and then there's some kind of moment where he starts to jump, and interpolating between those two points is in theory not that easy because, well, your body is just changed and the software doesn't know what to do. But couldn't you like use some kind of neural network to basically learn how bodies behave and then basically attach them and make certain points in between? And then I don't know, I'm just asking, I have no idea.
I think it's probably just faster and easier to do it with your hands, like straight from your mind, than to go through all these.
Yeah, I mean, I think the deep learning is an interesting topic. I haven't looked into it as much as I probably should, but I'm still pretty skeptical because, I mean, you need your training set, and you only get out what you put in. So if you have a really high quality training set that matches what you're trying to do, you probably get nice results. But you need to get the training set somehow. So if you can afford to hire dancers and like sports people and to do the motion capture and to provide the raw data, then sure, do that. But then you might as well just hire an actor to do exactly what you need to do.
Yes, true.
Here's
true.
An idea. No, you're right. Here's an idea. I think a big fundamental part of animation is, I think if you try and use motion capture, you're going to get a realistic motion. Say you have a perfect motion capture thing, right? $50,000 like OptiTrack tracking system and everything. You get like a perfect walking motion. But what you want in your animation is something a little bit more with more like soul and a little bit with more flair, you know, like. You want to have the character walk with the confidence that you want to build into that character, and you'll probably get that the most if you actually do it artistically and draw it and paint it and you know pose rig whatever. But if you want to bring machine learning back into this, say like each animator has kind of their own style that they move their characters in, and you want to then like have a training set where you're learning from a specific animator. Like all the motions that they have animated, and be able to do some kind of a style transfer into another character that you have rigged into walking into the style of an animator.
Yeah, I think the training
would
set
that
might
be a thing.
Yeah, the training set might be a little because I mean you're not doing multiple millions of animations, right?
No, I mean if you're using cameras now to do. You know, pose estimations of people, you know, with webcams of people just walking in front of you, you have all the points, you know, all their joints and understanding the poses that they're standing in. You can do that every frame. I don't know.
That's true. And what I was actually going to ask is, what do you expect with VR being more and more popular to change more? Because I'm right now actually filming something in a green screen, and obviously using you know the great capability of Unity that you can you know just plug in a third controller and everything just pops out. But I'm actually working with a wonderful professional called Francisca, so shout out to her. And she used to work in real movie productions where it was like so the whole green screen was always like a pain in the butt because they had like to key every frame, they had like to put special markers to track the people, and right now she's working with me and everything just pops out as a live keying and everything works greatly because well I have trackers on the person, I have trackers on the camera, there is less issues. So what you just described with your software, I'll cut it out. What you described with your software is another way how with VR you change another realm of content creation, of movie creation. And where I see VR kinda going more and more is allowing creative people to do things way different than before. Like, let's say with the mixed reality, I'm doing this very crude example, kind of way easier than before because the people have the trackers in their hands, I have a tracker on the camera, there is no post-production, just comes out as a live key. With your software, you don't need to do, you know, everything on paper or on the screen, you kind of do it with your hands, it's more natural. Where do you see the next steps that will be changed, revolutionized, or made easier with VR? So not only basically the animation part, but the content creation, but where does, do you see the technology go? So clearly you focused on your own product.
I mean,
but
I think I can tell it through the focus of our product, maybe what I think. Because one thing that I like is that since things become easier and more accessible, I think if we build tools for people to tell stories with, then we empower people who otherwise maybe wouldn't try to make a movie. They can just go into VR. It's kind of private. Nobody's watching them. And they can just try stuff out. And that's also why we're building a timeline and all these editing features so that you can get a feel for how do I edit something. Maybe I put some sounds in there and just to give them the possibilities to express themselves. And I think that we will push on that because I think that's an important thing. And it would be nice if more people would just create content and become content creators that way. And I think then it also goes back to a little bit into the interactive realm, because I think only creating stories that play for you, especially when you're in VR, is a little bit boring. So I think the step beyond would definitely be to bring in some interactive tools as well.
What was augmented reality? Is it going to play any role, or is it like better, you know, shut your own, your external world from you with a screen in front of you and just focus on what you're doing?
So, to be honest,
I think it doesn't matter that
much.
Yeah,
like, I'm still waiting for augmented reality that actually works. I think that's what why I'm doing things with VR right now, is because it works for what I want to do with it. I haven't seen any augmented reality device that actually does what it's what it promises to do. I mean, you have the phones that put things in the world, but I mean, do you really want to hold up your phone the whole time while you're interacting with content? At least for me, that's not really that enticing.
Yeah.
I've tried the virtual the augmented reality glasses, and they were mostly horrible. I mean, I haven't tried the Magic Leap.
Have you tried a HoloLens?
I haven't tried a HoloLens yet. I should do that.
You should.
I think that might change your opinion. That's going to change your opinion. I think that's the first. I had a big kind of like VR moment the first time I used the HoloLens, and I realized, I'm like, oh, the tracking works exactly how you expect it to work. And it sits where it needs to sit. And it, I mean, there's obviously other things with like the field of view not being what you want it to be, but like, it's coming. I think I wouldn't be too worried that it's like so far off that we don't, you know, it's not ever going to happen. It's just not there yet accessibly.
Well, I mean, for me, in the end, I think it's also, it's almost always the same. If I can exchange these goggles for some that let me see like also the reality and just augment stuff, and I can still draw and animate and maybe shut it out again if I need to. I think it's just going to melt together as soon as the technology catches up.
That's really interesting. And also my question was kind of aiming at, you know, content creation, the first question, and what Azad is doing, because he has a wonderful channel called Everyday Scan. And whenever I see what he manages to do with his wonderful skills, it kind of, you know, makes me a little bit jealous.
You just always want to plug me, man.
Yeah.
you just always want to plug me.
Yeah, I want to. I also think it's a great channel.
I know.
People should
subscribe
to it because it's great.
It's
not scripted.
We'll talk about it in a second, but it is your free will. I wanted to actually mention this, then the reason why I pull up the video is, and we haven't really talked about the broad scopes of what you can do in Anim VR, and apart from animating strokes and characters or moving models, I found it as a really great tool to do motion graphics animation. Where traditionally you'd want to do this in like After Effects, right? Mm-hmm. And just learn. And you're talking about like information density. And oh my God, like Adobe is just notorious for just filling up the screen with shit that you don't need to see. And so with Anim VR, you get not only get to like draw and move exactly the shapes that you want and do your animations, but also like place the camera and then grab the camera and record the motion of the camera with your hand. And, you know, all of those keyframes would be so difficult to do in a PC. So where I'm getting to is that I did my title my title screen for my like YouTube series in Anim VR. So you'll see it here in a second, and I'll post this in the links. It's I drew out, you know, every day a scan. I did a outline in blue and then a background with in white. they're all kind of like, it looks like old-timey animation because it's like running at like 12 FPS and each stroke has like motion to it. But I also imported all these, like I imported a camera model, a drone model, thing, and they're all kind of like moving around, doing their own thing. So there's some like big potential of stuff that you can do with just being able to animate with your hands and record that with a camera, that goes beyond VR and AR into just video. So I just wanted to put that out there. And for people that are just listening that, you know, don't understand why this would be relevant for them, I think it's just such a huge creative tool for people that don't want to spend the time, you know, like learning a new software. And so that's my testimonial. I just want to throw it out there. I'm a big fan, obviously. Okay, so we're running kind of low on time. Before we go away, I want to kind of quickly talk a little bit about like the general, like, so Quill came mm-hmm. out with their own animation tool, and I'm guessing you guys have tried yes. that. What does this do for this industry that you guys are, I guess, a part of? Do you have some thoughts on that?
First of all, the coolest thing about it is that VR animation suddenly gets a lot of attention, because I think they, since they belong to Facebook and Goro is a really well-known artist and he's really good at like sharing and explaining and this kind of stuff, I think it has shed a lot of light on what we were doing, like kind of in a niche, and what they've been doing as well, because they were a secret about it for a long time. But now that it's out, a lot of people get drawn into this virtual animation Facebook group, and there's so much That's content. Right. It's like this little creative explosion suddenly, which is really nice to see, because it's very inspiring to just look at what people create and try to create, and just take that back into our thoughts about, okay, what kind of tools do we need to make for them to empower them more in a way.
What would you say you've started to learn from seeing animation applied in other software like Quill?
I think with Quill, what they've really nailed is that you can build a place very easily. I think it's probably like what we've been focusing on is telling a story. And what they've really, really got down is that you can just take whatever the workflow that you were doing anyway with drawing in 3D and just bring your place that you were building alive with animation. And they have a lot of tools that make that very easy and very natural. And I think that's something that we had in AnimVR in the beginning, when AnimVR was a lot simpler. And since we've added the timeline and we've kind of been focusing on, okay, how do you tell a longer form story, we've lost this immediacy of creating a place. And I think that's something that we were pretty interested in when we saw Quill, is that all of these people that were creating still lives, basically, were now creating animated places. Right.
It's pretty nice to just go in there. You can kind of jam with yourself. It's like when you have a loop machine and you record your voice or something like that. And back in the days, NMVR was like that as well. You just had these individual loops of animation that would play all together. And with the timeline, we kind of lost the focus of that. I think we're going to bring it back at some point when we have time. But just seeing that and how alive these things feel that get made in there, and also like how fast people make them. It's really astounding. It's really nice to see. And I think they also, what they are really good at is that you don't have to go into any menus. You can keep a few panels open, but then you do everything with hotkeys and you duplicate something and it's animating. You do everything while the animation is running. And I think they did a really good job on that.
They do have a really nice, I noticed, I was watching Goro's live stream actually like yesterday or something. Dude, incredible to watch him work and see. It's so simple, like what he does, and then being able to replicate it, move it, scale it, and shape, and you can really create a beautiful little place island that is moving and has some life. I wouldn't knock the timeline too much though, because I think that is a huge aspect of AnimVR that fits directly into something like Unity that opens up the creative possibilities as to why you'd want to use Anim. To do things that are way beyond just Anim itself. I don't know if you can export that from Quill yet, you can create beautiful scenes within Quill, but like I see Anim kind of like reaching a way broader audience, with more professional people coming in, using it perhaps as not only a prototyping tool, but actually using the keyframes that you're, you know, creating and generating in Anim for their final project they're creating in Unity. Would you say that's like a fair assessment?
Yeah,
I think everything has kind of its place. Like, I think there's a place for this jamming and just this very loose way of working, because it's a lot of fun and it's fast. But as you said, it's also nice when you can then take the stuff that you create and put it in like a broader frame and give it some time and a sense of storytelling. And then on top of that, there would be the whole interactivity part, so that you can like maybe rig it in a way where when you look at something, an animation plays and stuff like mm-hmm. that. So I think, it's just these individual aspects of the thing.
I agree.
Good answer.
Sorry, I cut you off.
No. So if you got, I guess let's wrap this up. This has been a great conversation. How can people find out more about Anim VR, about the company Nevermind, and also individually, how can people follow you if you have Twitter accounts?
Yeah, sure. I mean, we have nevermind.io. The only thing to watch out for is that it's NVR Mind without the E's. And they can find everything that you need to know about Anim VR, and we also have our Twitter accounts linked there. So I think that's basically the hub to go.
We pushed a Facebook page live yesterday, I think. Oh. So you can also go there. I still have to add some stuff to it, but then you can get some support there as well. And on our website, you can also sign up for the beta version. You just click contact, and then you get the sign up form.
Yeah.
Hmm. And I think we'll do a bit more in terms of like online presence and tutorial videos and this kind of stuff when we're getting closer to the release version, because right now the app is changing so much that it's like a little bit of a waste of time since we are only the two of us.
That's fair. And individually, do you guys have accounts that you would have people contact you on?
Sure. I have a Twitter account. It's Da Zaip, so D-A Zaip, my last name. And you're happy to write me. I'm usually fairly responsive. I'm happy to answer questions, also programming questions, if you just have general, like, I do graphics programming a lot. So if you want to know something about shaders, I'm also happy to answer questions about shaders.
Nice.
Mm-hmm. I don't use Twitter that much. I'm also there. You can find me and stuff, but you can just write an email on our website. And that's mind@nevermind.io, the email address. And I usually reply to the emails, so that's fine as well.
Cool. And you can find us at ResearchVRcast on Twitter and ResearchVR Podcast on Facebook. And you can write an email to us at researchvrcast@gmail.com. And you can find our Discord community that we have started about a month or two ago, and it's growing. It's awesome seeing new users jumping in. We're having more and more discussions in there. We have actually guests that we either just interviewed or are going to interview talking within the channel and like discussing what they talking about, and I really like that aspect of things, because I feel like the episode itself lives on beyond just the recording. So you can find that as well in the show notes. Anything else you want to plug, Peter?
I'm quite good. I'm really happy we had this episode. It was really fascinating. It's a topic I have no clue about, and I have a feeling I understand it now better. So I'm looking forward to maybe even try it out. Maybe it's so easy I can learn animation without even knowing it.
I mean, I was able to do animation in it, and I'm terrible at art usually, so.
That gives me hope.
Quick shout out to the Facebook group. Was it Virtual Animation?
Yes.
Is that what it's called on Facebook? Great examples from Anim VR in there, as well as now Quill. Just fantastic inspiration, and it's like, it makes me want to jump in and like just replicate the things that I'm seeing in there. It's really, really cool. And apart from that, thank you, Milan and Dario, for joining us. This has been a fantastic episode. And
we'll see you guys next time. Thanks for having us.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks for joining. Bye. Goodbye.
Bye.